This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us this week for a look at the latest news developments in Greater Cincinnati, our City Hall reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Sharon Coolidge, WCPO.com business reporter Dan Monk, and Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. You can join us this afternoon by calling 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Sharon, Dan, and Chris, thanks for being here this afternoon. Good to see everybody.
Thanks for having us.
Sharon, let's start with what happened at Withrow High School on Saturday. We had some very ugly vandalism that occurred, anti-Semitic, racist graffiti that included several swastikas and racial slurs. So where's the investigation on this, Dan? Do police have any leads at this point on who might have done this?
You know, the police department, from my understanding, and there's been a couple meetings this week, you know, they have two very big cases going on. They have this one where they're trying to find the person who did this vandalism, and we have an unsolved homicide of a 9-year-old girl. Mm. And so they've had a very busy week, and I know they're prioritizing both of these things. And we just, you know, there's a lot of questions, and at the moment, they're not saying if they have a suspect or who might have done this.
Now, they had some video, though, that showed somebody that they think might be the suspect, I guess. Hearing that right?
This is somebody who went in and they planned this out. Not really caught on camera for just a brief moment, covered up with a mask, as close as we can tell, is a white male. That could be anybody. This was planned.
Mm-hmm. He looked kind of thin. That was about all you could see, though.
Yeah. Do they have any thoughts as to whether this might have been the same person who did this at Hebrew Union College?
You know, I haven't heard anyone say that it could be connected. It seems like it might be separate from its face value if you're looking at both of them, but I'm by no means an expert. But I wouldn't say the authorities are connecting the two.
Okay. What's been the reaction from the community? I mean, it's been pretty amazing how people have said, this is disgusting, and they've stood up against this, hasn't it?
So I was watching social media and all of the various news sites as this was breaking last Sunday when it was discovered. The community actually came out to clean this up. There were community members around there. The school, the city helped clean it up. They wanted this school to look exactly as it was when the students left on Friday, which was a pretty amazing kind of like overall thought. But people, they just came to clean it up. And then you saw really some activism where people were like, we want to welcome the students. And you didn't know what to expect, like how many people were going to go out. The Inquirer and every news media in town really sent a team to cover it. It was overwhelming. It was just, the idea was stand outside, have cars honk and, you know, support the kids and then clap them in as they walked into school. It was very emotional and it meant a lot to the students.
And that's been the silver lining in this story. I mean, it's a pretty disturbing story when you hear about something like this happening. But hearing things like that's the best part of it.
Absolutely. I mean, people, they cared about these kids. They care about education. And so the activism piece, it was a hopeful piece on Monday out of hate.
Now, Cincinnati already has a hate crime law in place, right? Is this prompting the city to look at its hate crime law again, maybe revamping it or beefing it up in any way, shape, or form?
The city has very tough hate crime laws, and that's not to say they're not looking at the law, you know, just in case there's other things they can be doing. But what they're really focusing on is reporting hate crimes. It's very difficult to do. And it's something that there is a protocol for, but doesn't really rise to the level of, you know, officers are looking at crimes for crimes. It's vandalism. But is there an underlying motivator to it? And so they're looking at those procedures to see if they can do anything better to help people report these crimes.
Now, State Representative Alicia Reese, she's calling for the Ohio Attorney General to look into the incident at Withrow. Where does that stand at this point? Have we heard anything, whether that phase of the investigation might actually occur or not?
I haven't heard that that's actually happening, but it's not like we have a police department that's not paying attention to this. This is, you know, all hands on deck to try and figure out who did this. So it is being looked at. I'm not sure. I feel like a lot of times when the attorney general gets involved, it's for smaller departments who don't have the manpower to really go out and like look at crimes that happen in these smaller communities.
Mm-hmm. Chris, any thoughts?
I was just thinking about this, and you know, it's interesting to me because you saw the public reaction, right? You saw people come out. It was very
very encouraging.
It was very encouraging and heartening. Yeah. And then you read some of the social media commentary, and it immediately dissolves into bile. And you see people immediately try to politicize it, say, well, it's liberals trying to make it seem like somebody who's associated with Trump did it. And then you got the counter argument to that. And I'm just glad that the real life example, you know, that went on in public didn't mirror anything that we saw on social media.
Again, 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join us in our conversation. Speaking of investigations, Chris, there was a new development this week in the flap at City Hall. I think you referred to it as a flap, which seems pretty good description, over some boxes that were moved from Councilman Charlie Winburn's office into the basement of City Hall. And if I understand it correctly, the implication was that he and his staff may have properly removed some public records.
Yeah.
So that was the implication. But then we have a new development this week. So where's this whole thing stand?
Well, and credit to the Inquirer for breaking the story on this. I mean, these boxes were taken down into the basement of City Hall at the very end of December by one of Councilman Charlie Winburn's aides. And basically word filtered up to the city solicitor that that this aide, whose name is Rosalind Foltz, intended to remove the boxes from City Hall. And so that kind of set off alarm bells with the city solicitor. So she called the cops. Two of the assistant police chiefs arrived at City Hall that night, or that day, I guess. And they basically decided that they needed to kick it over to a third-party investigation because they felt that if the city solicitor and or the Cincinnati Police Department investigated the boxes, that it would be deemed, you know, it would be politicized in one way or the other, depending on what the result was that they found. So the cops called the FBI. The FBI came and took the boxes. They didn't see anything that they thought was interesting, so they turned them over to the State Attorney General Mike DeWine's office. Correct me if I'm wrong, Sherry, but they sent some of the Bureau of Criminal Investigation people down and interviewed the janitors that saw the boxes. And
this is five boxes, right, Chris?
Five
this
boxes.
This is an excellent sum up.
I'm trying to do it as quickly
you
as I can.
It.
Because the facts are so scintillating.
So I will say, you know,
and they gave the boxes back to Charlie yesterday, basically, is the end of the story.
So and nothing really in the boxes that would be improper.
Well, yeah, I mean, Sherry looked through them a little bit closer than I did. I found a Wendy's cup in one of them, an empty smashed Wendy's cup. There was a lot of handwritten notes, city council agendas, presentations. It was five boxes filled with some garbage.
Basically nothing?
Yeah, basically nothing that I saw. And if there was something, I think that the FBI probably would have hung on to it. So
I will say, I don't know why Roz wanted to take the boxes home, but she's super organized. These were mostly notes every day. They're dated by day, and they're like all the messages that came in, there's phone numbers on them, and it's kind of like things she has to do as an aide. Like, it's like basically boxes of her to-do lists. I didn't see anything that would rise to a level.
Did you see
that
the
would
Wendy's
interest
cup?
Authorities.
Did you see the Wendy's
I didn't
cup?
See the Wendy's
so
cup.
You can verify that Chris is not fibbing about the Wendy's cup.
I think that we can assure the taxpayers of Cincinnati that Rosalind Foltz, they are getting their money's worth as a city council aide out of her. That is for sure. That is the one thing we know.
But this is why, you know, we thought that it was a story from the get-go. Myself and Dan Horn and, you know, other people have written some about it, are under the impression that there was an FBI investigation into the Metropolitan Sewer District. There was a lot of things going on. It has to do with contracting and payments made.
So it revolved around procurement.
Yes.
Okay.
So that is something and we believe is going on. It's not like the FBI is coming out and saying, hey, we're investigating everybody. It's something we believe is going on. And so when I was in City Hall and I've heard what happened and that we have boxes that the FBI is looking at, no matter how they got into the hands of the FBI, which, you know, there's a lot of hoopla around that. To us, that was a very important fact. It had nothing to do with Charlie Winburn. Anybody who the FBI boxes from any office that the FBI got involved in, we would be interested in wondering why that is. Mm-hmm. That does not happen every day.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, and you're right. The whole issue over MSD with all the legal issues surrounding that, that is important. If it had something to do with that, it needed to be brought out.
So it's kind of devolved into a sideshow yesterday with, you know, Charlie saying, I've been vindicated, and no one was accusing him of wrongdoing. But it is this underlying issue. And so the city solicitor, and I feel like an unprecedented move, outlined everything that happened in a 4-page letter, very detailed about what happened. It was the first time that any city official on the record said, the FBI is investigating the Metropolitan Sewer District, and she then went into what was going on with the Bureau of Criminal Investigations. That is a huge fact, and it's gotten, you know, all of this, what's going on with what's in the boxes, and all of these things are interesting facts and at times salacious, but the fact...
Scintillating, I think was the word.
But the fact, and a flap, you know, but
yeah.
The idea that we have confirmation that the FBI is looking at our sewer district is very important.
Yeah,
That FBI thing is really interesting that she revealed that or acknowledged that. And I tried to do a little bit more asking about that on, I guess it was either Wednesday or Thursday, and I was curious whether the city manager knew that. I mean, let me back up a little bit. So about last winter, I read, of course, Inquirer's stories, and typically in the FBI, when they investigate somebody, you know, they subpoena something. They ask for records. They show up with a truck at your door and take all your computers. You know, things like that happen. And, you know, I wanted to see whether any of that had happened with the city, and the city basically said no. They didn't. They refused to turn over any subpoenas. They said they didn't have any, basically. And, you know, they did acknowledge actually an FBI investigation of something else. So it made me think, well, they're probably not lying to me. And so that was about a year ago. And so the fact that she acknowledged this today or 2 days ago or whatever is interesting. And it makes me wonder whether, you know, what has changed to make the city acknowledge that. You know, I was curious whether the city manager knew that before she wrote it in a letter. I didn't really get a definitive response from the city. And so I think in the coming days and weeks, I think there's some more digging around that ought to be done about that.
Think there's more to come still?
I don't know if there is or not. I really have no idea. Okay. But
so the Inquirer agrees. Yeah. But he makes a good point, is that no one really has been talking about it. So there's a lot. So there's some speculation here. But what if the city is cooperating and they didn't need a subpoena?
Right. Could be. Could be.
And they just don't want to talk about it.
Could be. Hmm. I mean, last year when, City Manager Black, I think, he spoke on the record about it to me, and he said, well, we had one employee interviewed by the FBI with some very non-specific questions, I think was the term he used roughly, and that was it. And, I asked the director of MSD, are you aware of an investigation? No. The answer was no, they were not. So something has changed in the last since I did that story.
Yeah, where they even acknowledge it now.
Right, where they're acknowledging it on the record in a letter from the city solicitor, the city's chief attorney. So it's interesting to me, I was curious at that point, well, is this FBI investigation a deal where somebody called and said, hey, you really ought to check into this? And with most things, the FBI probably takes at least a cursory look at every tip that they have, even if it comes from somebody who they think maybe it's not all that credible. So there's degrees of investigation and there's degrees of whatever. And so I'm curious what degree they are at right now with the city.
So the box flap, that's more than likely over. But MSD, for sure, that's going to be...
It produced something interesting.
Yeah, that's going to be an ongoing thing. And we will continue our conversation. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Shogren. I cover the environment for National Public Radio. One of the things that's so great about working on stories for NPR is that anybody can listen to NPR. You don't have to be rich enough to get a subscription. You don't have to be rich enough to have a computer to go online. All you have to do is turn on the radio. And so NPR is this place where reporters can dive deep and learn about things and then tell people all across the country what's going on, or maybe tell them what are questions that might be worth answering or asking. And that's I think that's a pretty wonderful thing about NPR. And without listener support, of course, none of this would be possible.
This is WVXU and WMUB's Winter Fun Drive. As a matter of fact, it is the last day of the Fun Drive. And if you've never given before, take that first step now. It's individual contributions from listeners like you that keep the news and information you depend on every day on the air. You can give online at WVXU.org or WMUB.org, or you can call, and I know Chris just wants to do this. You can call.
Is my mic on?
Yeah, there it turned is. His mic off.
They turned my mic off.
You've been dying to do this. I just know.
It's 419-7155. That's area code 513. I encourage everybody to give today. I listen to NPR all the time. I listen to it on the way to work. I listen on the way home. So I think it's a valuable resource. Even though I got to sit next to Jay Hanselman all the time at City Council, it's all right.
You know,
I'm willing to pay a salary.
You have to sit next to him when you come in here and do the show sometimes. Yeah,
true.
So, yeah.
We love Jay, but you know, something to point out about some news organizations, and NPR is one of them. They assign somebody specifically to cover your city government, as does the Business Courier, as does the Inquirer. It's no cheap proposition to allow one reporter to really focus on something. And our city government is a $1.1 billion operation that touches everyone's lives. And having somebody cover directly, I mean, when people talk to me about the Inquirer's coverage, I point that out because that is a very valuable thing that these news organizations are willing to do for the community.
And it's time-consuming. It's time-consuming.
Yes, it is.
Well, and like you're saying, it's not a cheap proposition. Again, you can make your contribution at 513-419-7155. You can also give online at WVXU.org or WMUB.org. And Sharon and Chris, thanks for helping me out with that. That was good.
No problem.
Let's go back again. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and my guests this afternoon are Cincinnati Inquirer City Hall reporter Sharon Coolidge, WCPO.com business reporter Dan Monk, and Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wedrick. And if you'd like to join us, 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's go back. We were talking about Charlie Winburn and the box investigation being basically over at this point.
Yeah.
Now, what is his status in running for mayor? Because I keep hearing he's going to run, maybe he's not. We're just not 100% sure at this point.
So Charlie's gone to the Board of Elections, and he's pulled petitions to run for mayor. You know, we had a nice little side conversation with him out in the hallway yesterday. And I was curious to see whether he was actually gathering those signatures, right? Because anybody, you know, you or I could go take petitions out tomorrow. It doesn't necessarily mean we're going to go run for mayor. And he wouldn't answer whether he's gathering the signatures. He wouldn't give us a timetable for when he's going to decide. So we don't really know any more than that. One of the council, I don't want to say who, but somebody who had filed for election in 2015 or 14, I can't remember which, said that Charlie had been, I think it would have been 14, because that's when Charlie was trying to decide whether to run for county commissioner or county auditor. What did he run for in 14? I'm losing my mind. Treasurer.
Yes. The Senate? No.
No, the Senate was 14. 16. That's when he was running for one of the county offices.
So recorder.
He was, recorder. Right, recorder. Sorry. So he was sitting there with two sets of petitions at the Board of Elections as the deadline approached in 2016, trying to decide whether he was going to file for commissioner or auditor. He eventually turned in the auditor ones and ended up losing in the primary. Charlie is he's a politics addict, and it's going to be very hard, I think, for him not to run, but I'm not sure that he will.
So the filing deadline's February 16th. I'll see you with the Board of Elections. What do you think? Yep. 3:59 p.m. for our actual answer of whether he's running or not.
Right.
Dan, would you agree with that? I think I would, too. I think it's probably going to be a last-minute thing.
Everything except for being at the Board of Elections at 3:59.
You won't be there.
We won't be there, but we'll agree with your prediction.
So, but, you know, whether he gets into the race or not is not just, you know, interesting. He changes the dynamic of this race of, you know, we'll have a primary in May with the runoff. We already have Rob Richardson Jr., a Councilwoman Yvette Simpson, and, of course, our mayor's running for reelection. It's like, what does a Republican running, and Charlie in particular, who has a big following in the black community, what does that mean for this race? And so that's why we're all watching it so closely. Not because we're like, oh, is another candidate running?
Right.
Because it's going to affect the outcome of the race for sure.
He shakes it up, you know. And Charlie's gotten a lot of support from the business community over the years. And John Cranley, the current mayor, I mean, I think has really locked that up. So I'm curious whether if Charlie would run, could he really get much support from them? You know, Charlie's kind of a, he considers himself a protege of the late Carl Lindner, and you know, that's kind of where he really comes from. He manages to straddle, you know, the 4th Street business establishment, but then also has a great following and has a lot of supporters in the African American community while being a Republican at the same time. It's really a rare thing in urban politics, I think, across the country.
And we got some other news in the mayor's race this week, and Yvette Simpson picked up a significant endorsement.
Yeah, she posted a video earlier this week of her being endorsed by Marion Spencer, the civil rights icon in Cincinnati. She really kind of led the effort to desegregate Coney Island and Sunlight Pool, and so that was that's a huge deal for her. It's her biggest endorsement to date, and it's a big one.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join us. And let's talk to Jordan in Bond Hill. Hi, Jordan. Hello, Jordan. Okay, so it sounds like we've lost Jordan. Let's move on to something that you wrote about this week, Sharon, about the streetcar. I thought this was a very interesting piece. You took a look into the streetcar operations, and specifically you were looking at the question of why is the streetcar late? So in your research, what did you find out?
You know, it was a fascinating data set to take a peek at.
Yeah.
It came out of 2 weeks ago now, almost a three-hour transportation committee meeting where they talked about a lot of issues facing the streetcar. And there's just been a focus on the ridership. And, you know, a lot of people, they think that's not the only measure of what's going on. And I agree, it's one measure, not all measures. And so it was like, so why? What's really slowing things down? And it was just this gigantic list. We turned it into a database. It's searchable on the Inquirer's website. I encourage you, you know, to take a look at it. You can look at all of them yourselves. And if you, the number one problem is emergency vehicles parking on the tracks. Which I'm
emergency vehicles?
Emergency police, fire, and ambulances.
I guess sometimes that's out of necessity, but
sometimes I would definitely say it's out of necessity. Yeah. But then you look at it, it's like, can they park across the street? Like you don't really. You don't know. That's the number one thing. But there were just so many things, and it all boiled down to one thing.
And
people.
People.
It's like these are fixed. These are fixed rails. And, you know, there was some, like, speculation. They're like, well, maybe, you know, people coming downtown, they don't really know. How you could not know about the streetcar at this point, I do not know.
Yeah.
Like, we have a streetcar. It runs. There's rails in the ground. You see them. I mean, when the rails first went in the ground outside Findlay Market, I take my family there. I take my son there. The first time those rails appeared outside Findlay Market, my little boy is like, "Is there a train somewhere?" and he was so excited. So he noticed the rails right off. It's hard to imagine you're not seeing the rails.
Yeah. So you're finding it's just a matter of people either aren't used to it or they're just ignoring it, or
I think it's both. We rode around with a parking enforcement officer. I'll tell you what, this is quite the job. There are actually people assigned to drive the streetcar route for parking enforcement and kind of like get out ahead of the streetcar and warn people, like, your car's parked in the way. Get your Brinks truck off of here. There's no beer deliveries right now. A streetcar is coming. And so this is his actual job. And he was very nice. And he said there are repeat offenders. And he talked about, he's like, everyone's pretty nice. He's like, Uber drivers are a huge problem outside of Rheingeist. And he said he sees the same ones. They're picking people up. They don't want to go across the street. They want, you know, the person to have a good Uber experience and kind of come right out of Rheingeist and get into an Uber. And he's like, but I talked to them. He's like, I have repeat offenders. So they know what they're doing.
But if it's an Uber driver, can't they just leave when the streetcar shows up? They're parking and then waiting for their passenger to come?
Yes, and if the street, they know,
and they
the street,
won't,
the
they
street
won't
car
move,
will
and the
stop.
Streetcar is right behind them.
Yeah,
that detail about the guy whose job it is to, that was really interesting. Is he writing tickets for other things at the same time, or is his job literally only to get people off the tracks?
He called it the streetcar beat, which I said to him, "Oh, we have something in common."
Yeah, no kidding.
I'm on the streetcar beat.
He was
right
very
now, yeah.
Nice, but you know, the city's taking this very seriously, along with SORTA. The money comes out of the streetcar budget to pay for these parking enforcement officers to really look at the streetcar, you know, route and make it smooth, because they need it to be reliable, for people to ride on it. And they're taking this seriously. And they're like, if this is what it takes to do, this is what it takes to do.
So beyond somebody who enforces this, though, I mean, what do they need? A better education program? You know, telling people don't park on the streetcar tracks?
God, it would seem obvious, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, but maybe not.
Okay.
It would, but, and I think they are ticketing people. And so things, since they've started really ticketing people, it's fallen some. It's kind of leveled off. And they're hoping that the tickets, you know, helps improve things all the way down to I'm not parking on the tracks anymore.
What is the fee for parking on the streetcar?
$50. It's similar to a parking ticket, which is $45. Mm-hmm. The one thing I will say is we do have narrow streets, which, you know, there's parking spaces next to the streetcar line. Mm-hmm. And you can – there's a white line that runs all along the route. You cannot park over the white line. It's actually something I personally never knew or really paid attention to, other than the fact I know not to park in the way of the streetcar. But there is a line. You got to park inside of it. And if you do, in the streetcar itself, if you're on the it's on the rails, the rail line actually is the distance. It doesn't go beyond the rail line.
Mm-hmm. You were talking, too, Sharon, about the declining numbers in ridership. That's been in the news a lot lately. Is anybody, any city official, anybody panicked about this yet?
I won't want to use the word panicked. I'll get in trouble.
Concerned. Well, concerned.
I'll get
but
in
nobody
trouble.
Said. So I guess nobody's hit the panic button yet, but there are concerns about it.
You know what? There is a hope that things, you know, they say streetcars are, you know, they're more popular when it's nice out. People don't want to wait at stations for when it's cold. There is definitely a working theory that things will be better in the spring.
You know, there's two ways to measure success with this thing. One is how much investment it's spurring, which the people that were really for it when it was being conceived, I think they would tell you that's kind of their number one reason for doing it. The second would be, you know, how does it move people around? And SORTA and the city have really done a poor job at making sure that it runs on time, number one, and that people know when it comes. The fact that we've had multiple committee meetings trying to figure out why the real-time arrivals signs don't work. I mean, it's just unbelievable that it's been in operation since September and that's not been fixed.
And tested for almost a year.
Yeah, tested for – I forgot about that.
I think Chris Seelbach was threatening to have the company that runs those arrival signs
I mean, city council doesn't have the power to fire a contractor for SORTA. That was – it's going to be symbolic. It shows that they're angry about it, and that's all well and good. But SORTA and this contractor need to fix the problem, and the city needs to get its traffic study done, because you know the fact of the matter is our traffic system is oriented to get people out of the city and onto the highway. It's not a modern 21st century traffic system where we see the resurgence of urban living and people walking and being downtown. And the fact that they didn't do that before the streetcar opened, when they had a year to do it, is equally appalling. So I think the city and the SORTA, you know, they share the responsibility for that.
Can you still ride the streetcar for free? Just get on and ride around without a ticket?
No.
You
know, I think as we've got, there was definitely a grace period. But now mm-hmm. they have, you know, they're paying.
They've written tickets.
Off-duty yeah. officers. I've had more than one person tell me that they've been, not even complain, just to say, you know, they checked.
Oh, I've had people tell me they've gotten tickets and they're not happy about it.
Yeah. So they're cracking down on that for sure.
They are, yeah.
I think the big measure for whether the streetcar is successful long term is going to be whether it changes the behavior of resident people that live downtown, developers, et cetera. In other words, are we going to preserve more of the historic property in over the Rhine? Is a lot of that going to get converted? Will we have higher densities downtown? And or are we going to keep subsidizing parking garages, you know, for people to park for less than the market rate when they're living in apartments that are subsidized by the city as well? So, I mean, to me, that's the big advantage of the streetcar and always has been. It'll preserve the built environment downtown and enable more development in a confined space.
Yeah, Dan's totally right about that, especially, you know, when this downtown Kroger that someday is going to apparently be built. Any day now, right? You know, once you have a grocery store and you have those staple services where you don't have to leave downtown for or over the Rhine for much else other than maybe you have a family member or whatever. I think that's right.
You know, and we did see, you know, a hardware store open right. along the line. That was hailed as a very big deal for living downtown, that you don't have to leave. It's on the streetcar route. Acme Hardware, I think
it's called. Going to be called Woods Hardware now, but it was called Acme. He's changing the name of it. Yeah.
And so that is giving the people the ability to go there, buy things, get on the streetcar, and go to their respective homes. And we also saw, I haven't followed this that closely, but at Elm and Henry, a big development that's going to be built without parking. It's on the streetcar route.
And that's a huge deal. The parking piece is key, right? I mean, you see the Rick Riwee's condo project near where the infamous Denison Hotel is. That is not going to have as much parking as you would have typically expected a building like that to have. So, you know, that's key, is to see whether the city can quit subsidizing to the tune of tens of millions of dollars, maybe even hundreds of millions. Dan,
they cost $15,000 or $20,000 to build every space. So.
Well, I'll say at this point, Sharon, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
City Hall reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Sharon Coolidge. Dan Monk and Chris Wederick will join us in the next half of the show as we look at local business news of the week. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.
My name is Jimmy Wales, and I'm the founder of Wikipedia. Like NPR, we get most of our money from contributions of $50 to $100. And those small contributions are important. They tend to keep you honest, right? The listeners, the people who are really passionate and care about what you're doing, and you have to respect them. And I think when people think about the funding of NPR, it's important to keep the public service mission to it. NPR does raise the majority of its funds from the listeners, and that keeps NPR honest, and that's really important.
Support from listeners like you is what keeps WVXU and WMUB going strong, and that's why we're asking for you to contribute right now. Please do your part by becoming a sustaining member with a contribution of $10 a month on your credit or your debit card. You can contribute online at WVXU.org or WMUB.org, or by calling 513-419-7155. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. We'll shift the conversation to local business news of the week. And joining us now, Cincinnati Inquirer business reporter Alex Coolidge, WCPO.com business reporter Dan Monk, and Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wederick. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Alex, good to see you this afternoon. And Chris and Dan, good to see both of you too, even though we said hi earlier. So
I'm still here.
You're
Hello,
still
again.
Here. Let's start with some earnings reports that we got this week. Latest numbers on Fifth Third, they were up 9% for 2016 compared to 2015's profit. What was behind that, Alex? What was driving those numbers?
Fifth Third's really basically soldiering through the aftermath of post 2008 financial crisis.
So they're still trying to come out of that the recession.
It's just been a very slow, sluggish slog. The last 6-7 years, the environment for banks has been basically super low interest rates, lots of regulation, and a lot of just going sideways, basically. Now, we've seen since the Trump election, we've seen a huge pop in all the bank stocks since November, including Fifth Third. We've seen a 20-plus percent spike, and that's a very interesting development. There's a lot of optimism that the economy might get a little better under a Republican administration. Regulation might get a little better, but also we're going to continue to see interest rates go up higher. And also, if we have a free spending administration that's promised a whole lot of infrastructure spending, we might also see more inflationary pressures, which will spur up interest rates, and that helps banks. So basically, banking is like going Oh, my God. Thank you.
Is that what they're doing, Dan? Are they?
Yeah, I think they pretty much are looking forward to the Trump era. I think they are, yeah. Less regulation, higher interest rates, that's all good. You know, when your business is borrowing money at this rate and then doubling it and making your profit, if the original rate is next to zero, it's kind of hard to make money.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think they would like a higher interest rate environment.
Yeah, while they're also waiting for that, and while they have been waiting for that, another thing that Fifth Third's been doing in the last year and a half, 2 years or so, is they've been trying to ramp up revenues, income from fees. Now, the second I say that, you're thinking, oh my God, the ATM charge. They only really they get fee income from all sorts of businesses, from financial advice to very wealthy people to business consulting, all that sort of thing.
So I was talking about fees on your checking account and things like that.
Yeah.
They do that too, though.
Yeah, they do that too. But all in, you know, fees on consumer accounts is something like less than 20% of all fee income for the bank. I mean, the rest is, mortgage processing and all that fun stuff. Anyway, the new CEO there, Greg Carmichael, who's been in the saddle since about November 2015, very interesting fellow. He has he came up through the technology part of the bank, and he was actually a tech guy. He's not an accountant or a lawyer or anything like that. And he's really been making a bunch of small acquisitions, including one last week where he's buying fintech companies and then also service businesses that could augment their fee income. They just bought out a local shop, I forget the name. It's a local retirement agency base. They give retirement planning advice.
But it sounds like he's going down some different avenues that maybe might not be your traditional avenues for banks to go down.
And they have to do that. They also have while the community is also hoping, gee whiz, maybe we'll have less regulations and maybe we'll even have some bank mergers, which has been a huge growth avenue for banking in the past. I mean, Fifth Third is under George Schaefer. He did 36 acquisitions under his tenure and grew the bank from a small tri-state regional, a little smaller than I think First Financial Bank, to one of the 15, 20 largest banks in the country. That's not looking very promising right now. They have a poor grade from the CRA, which complicates traditional bank acquisitions. But then also,
and CRA is the Community Reinvestment Act.
Okay. They got dinged by regulators on that. But then also another thing is, while Fifth Third's traditional currency for acquisitions is much richer because the stock price jump, everybody who they would ordinarily buy have also seen their bank stocks shoot up. In fact, small banks have seen their stocks shoot up even higher. Regional banks have seen like a 22% spike since November 7th. I mean, we're talking like weeks. But then smaller banks, First Financials and LCNB type community banks have seen their stocks jump close to 30% in the same time frame. So they've suddenly become more expensive.
We also heard from Procter & Gamble this week, and I believe that was almost an $8 billion second quarter profit that they recorded, Dan. Is that right?
Huge chunk of that was a result of the spinoff of the beauty brands that they divested to Coty.
I think the bigger news there was the fact that they've proven they can grow sales again. And I think, they increased their outlook for revenue growth. I think they're now expecting between 2 and 3% revenue growth. And
organic sales, yeah. That's It's actually it's a double-edged prediction because they also at the same point the market very closely scrutinizes organic sales. It's seen as sort of a pure way of it eliminates Forex and M&A, and it's a way of sort of purifying.
Right,
sales growth.
Organic sales are what your business does. Their sales,
what it does.
Right, as opposed to acquisitions and things like that.
But they also conceded Forex is still a thorn in their side. Over the last two full fiscal years, foreign exchange has obliterated something like $9 billion worth of sales. Just gone from – that just didn't happen – because they were translating, you know, euros into dollars and pesos back into dollars and the Chinese yuan back into dollars. And, you know, well, as part of their latest development, they also said, oh, well, all in, the real sales are actually going to be flat for this fiscal year, even though organic sales are going to be a little better. So they're saying our core sales are improving. But Forex continues to be a problem, and in recent weeks and recent months, the market had really been hoping that Forex was going to quiet down, and it looked like it was doing that. And then we had Trump elected, and then we saw currencies around the world start going down. I think the Mexican peso is down more than 12% in just a few weeks, and Brexit still hasn't the Brexit effect is still in full effect, and I'm sorry,
none of which P&G can control.
Right, it's not their fault. They just got to live with it.
Yeah, when you're doing business globally, that's one of the things that you have to face is those currency fluctuations. You, Dan, you actually got to talk with the CFO of Procter & Gamble about what he's expecting in a Trump administration. So what are his expectations?
In the media call that they do in advance of earnings, I asked what the expectation is in terms of, is Trump going to start a trade war? And China's pretty key for Procter & Gamble. They've reversed a slump there, and they're growing sales again. His expectation is that that there will be no policy change that'll affect the sort of the long-term dynamics of doing business in China, which they regard as very positive, and he can't see anything that is going to be on the horizon that'll reverse that long-term advantage of doing business in China.
Mm-hmm. And he also had a take on the tax reforms that Trump is proposing. I mean, he thought those would be a positive thing as well, didn't he?
I think that, a lot of business owners and business leaders are really energized by the idea that the Trump administration is going to reduce corporate taxes. They've talked about a rate as low as 15%. They've talked about reducing the amount of tax on overseas profits. There's a lot of companies, Procter included. I think it has like $49 billion worth of overseas earnings that have yet to be repatriated, brought back to the U.S. And most companies would like to have the ability to move their cash around for whatever purpose, either investing in a new factory in the U.S. or elsewhere, or more likely paying dividends, and P&G is a big dividend payer. So I think P&G is pretty optimistic about the prospect of tax reform this time around and the prospect of paying lower taxes.
Mm-hmm. And Alex, as far as expectations from companies around Cincinnati, I mean, how they're looking at in terms of how is this going to affect trade, right?
The business community is very optimistic about the pro-growth prospects under Trump and lower taxes, but they're also very nervous about all the trade talk. Greater Cincinnati actually produces nearly half of the state's exports. We have a lot of exposure to trade tensions. If there's a disruption, if there's a trade war, if the situation with Mexico got really out of hand, it could disrupt some business potentially. No one's predicting that's going to happen. Everybody's, you know, hoping that this is just politics right now, but wait and see, to be continued, you know.
Yep. Now, Kroger, we got some news from Kroger this week. It's the company says it's going to be doing a lot of hiring. What is it, 10,000 people they're planning on,
yes,
on hiring? These are permanent positions, Alex?
Yeah, these are permanent positions in the stores. It's actually it's a little less than in some – they've been up and down throughout the last few years about how many – they've actually had some years where they've acquired – where they've added like 25,000 jobs in a year or so, but part of that is through acquisitions. They bought out Harris Teeter. That brought on, you know, several thousand jobs. That was 2014, and then also they just bought Roundy's a little over a year ago, and that added a whole bunch there. So, but this is an organic figure, so 10,000.
It's kind of interesting that this comes on top of the news we got back in, I think it was in December, that they were going to offer voluntary layoffs to early retirement, voluntary early retirement to 2,000 of their employees.
The Dow just went above 20,000, and all the big players in town just sort of seemed not really invited to the party. Proctor's kind of fretting because they're a safety stock, so a lot of investors, a lot of big institutions park money into Procter as a safety move when other sectors fall out of favor, cyclicals. Well, with Trump talking infrastructure and, you know, all this other stuff, you know, suddenly cyclical stocks suddenly are becoming hot, so banking shoots up, industrials shoot up, materials shoot up. All that money that's going into those sectors gets unparked from where it was before. So we're seeing P&G not really invited to the party because money's actually coming out of Procter stock to be put into other stocks. Kroger and Macy's, though, are actually both suffering from, you know, just sort of this not very happy Christmas that we just saw.
Well, it's deflation in Kroger's case, isn't
right.
it, that they're struggling with, Dan, right?
Yeah, falling grocery prices are impacting their profits.
How much are we expecting them to impact?
I don't recall what the number was, but I do recall that they thought deflation would be a factor in their earnings through at least the first half of this year and perhaps beyond that. And in the last quarter, they barely had same-store sale growth or identical store sale growth, which is one of their trademarks. You know, they've had like
12 straight years of increasing comps.
Right.
And that's sort of a measure of their growing market share. And it, like, you're right, it was like
one-tenth of 1%
growth. So it's got,
which made me happy, you know, that I bought that extra six-pack on the way home.
Hey, speaking of infrastructure, too, because you mentioned that, Alex, under the Trump administration, the Brent Spence Bridge, number two, I think, on the list reportedly of Trump priorities, Chris.
So there's a McClatchy newspaper story that came out earlier this week, and it basically had his top, I think it was top 52, and Brent Spence was number two on it. There's some dispute over whether this is a real Trump list or some kind of trial balloon or whatever, but clearly it's on his agenda. The interesting thing for Northern Kentucky, which is just hell-bent against paying any tolls on that bridge or on the span that would be built next to it, is that his plan depends upon revenue coming from these projects and public-private partnerships. So we may have the same debate we've had
that we've been having for decades.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Good to be here.
Good to be here.
Cincinnati Inquirer business reporter Alex Coolidge, WCPO.com business reporter Dan Monk, and Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wedrick. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. Pete Reitmeier was the producer for today's show. Belinda Kai was the assistant producer. Dave Shermer was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney. Thank you.
Last year, the Northern Kentucky Health Department developed an online data resource to provide a better understanding of the heroin epidemic. On the next Cincinnati edition, we'll look at what the numbers tell us about the heroin crisis. We'll also discuss the competition between startups and blue-chip companies. And in Focus on Technology, how a bug with bifocals helps scientists learn more about human eyes and cameras. That's Cincinnati Edition, Monday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.